Well, good morning.
Good morning.
It really is a wonderful world, and we have much to be grateful for, and all of us have received so many blessings. I go over to the Cleveland Clinic. I had a detached retina a few years ago, and I go over there regularly to the Cole Eye Institute, and I always enjoy, you know, nobody likes going to a hospital setting, but if you have to go, Cleveland is really quite remarkable. I'm so impressed. There are people from all over the world who go there, who attend, who work there, and it's all working. Like, we're all getting along. We're all functioning well together. It's like, see, this can work. We can be a community of diverse people. So, Karen asked me to speak. I thought, oh gosh, now what am I going to talk about? And most of you probably know I'm on a glide path to retirement. I'm taking my time. But it's causing me to reminisce quite a bit. I've got 42, 43 years in now, and the stories that I haven't thought about it come rushing back. And yesterday when I sat down to really kind of map out what I was going to say today, I remembered this one young person. This would have been 1984, and she had a way of saying things. For example, she would say, oh, I'll be ready in an hour, not even 30 minutes. Just felt backwards, like, anyway. Or she would say, how come every time I hear you, you're talking? and so stories like that have just been flooding back into my brain. I originally thought I would identify, you know, 5 to 10 lessons that I've learned over the course of my career. And I came up with things like, you know, adapting to situations as needed, repeating important information many times, connecting authentically with others. And then I got to yesterday and I thought, oh, this is really, it's good stuff, but it's boring. I can't give this talk. I'm going to have to change it up a little bit. So then I thought, well, let's just tell stories. And why stories? And I remember, and again, this goes back probably 25 years. I was working in central Pennsylvania, and we had contracted with a national speaker. He's a former law enforcement officer who does trainings for police on how to investigate domestic violence crimes. And we contracted with him to come to our community, and he did a 40-hour training there every day, 5 days, and we had police there, we had my staff there, some first responders. Gave a great training. About a year later, I was talking with my staff, and I said, hey, how many of you remember that training? And what do you remember from that training? Well, nobody remembered anything except the story that he told at the end of the training. He kind of gave a personal testimonial of how he personally had grown up in a home where there was domestic violence and how he felt powerless to help and to do anything and how he hid under the porch when his father went into one of these moments. That resonated with everyone, and that they remembered. They remembered all the details of that story. And it got me thinking, we really are hardwired for stories, right? This is how we used to learn. This is how cultures passed along the traditions and histories of their culture. Josh Searle White would probably attest to that, right? The power of stories. And so we kind of hammer this at home in women's services, you know. Don't tell a story without statistics, and don't tell any statistics without a story. Storytelling. So I'm going to tell you 5 stories and what they taught me. So the first goes back to 1982 when I first started working in human services. I had just come out of college. I was working in a group home that was made up of adjudicated youth. And I remember this young man who was being picked on and bullied by the other boys in the program. And they had done something particularly heinous to him. And I sat him down and we were talking, and he just opened up and shared all the horrible things that his father had done to him. This was the first time I had ever heard anything like this. I grew up in a loving, functional home, was not exposed to any of this ugliness. It just blew me away. I can still recall that conversation. I know just about everything he said to me on that particular day. And I'm not going to go into all the details because they're not pretty. But that really opened up my eyes to how horrible we can be to one another. And for a father to do this to his son just felt unimaginable. A few years later, they assigned me to the girls' unit. Now, I thought I'd seen everything working with teenage boys. Oh, working with teenage girls was double the fun. And in particular, there was this one young lady who could have been perhaps the poster child for an angry teenager. She was quite angry, and you knew there was something eating away at her. And so I persisted in trying to get at that. And it took about a year, and she put me through hell testing me to see if I was worthy of her story. And apparently she eventually felt that I was, and so she proceeded to tell me how her parents had divorced, and her mother then took up with this new guy, and that guy sexually abused her older brother, who was about 12 at the time. And then he left the home, but the brother then began sexually abusing her when she was 10 to 12 years of age. And it went on for a number of years. And so she was carrying around this secret, which to her was a shameful secret. And it made her angry. It made her angry at her father for leaving. It made her angry at her mother for not protecting her. It made her angry with her brother who perpetrated this abuse on her. It made her angry with the boyfriend who started this whole cycle. She was angry with teachers and counselors who didn't understand what she was going through. She was angry. And I learned from that experience and all those experiences in the group home that really what ails us as a society stems from what happens to children as they're growing up. What we see today, the mental health afflictions, not all of it, but a good bit of it, addiction, exploitation, the violence, all of this has its roots in adverse childhood experiences, which were explored and uncovered in the 90s by a couple of doctors out in California. And so we know that trauma plays a horrendous role in everything that we're seeing today. And while adverse childhood experiences aren't destiny, meaning not every kid who's been mistreated or abused goes on to abuse others or be dysfunctional, but when you look at people in our society who are perpetrating horrible crimes against others, oftentimes there is a history of abuse. And so it affects all of us, and we have to get at this. And the key is connection. The people in the drug and alcohol field will tell you that the antidote for substance use disorder is not sobriety, it's connection. I love that. When you talk to people about how you create a more cooperative, collaborative, caring community, they'll tell you it's about connection. I think all of you come to church because of those connections. Connection. That was the thing that I learned from working with these young people. These were kids who had lacked connection, who had connections severed, and were dying to get those connections reformed. When I left there, I went to work in a day treatment program in Gettysburg. These were kids that we would pick up in the morning, they'd be there all day, and then we'd take them home. And we had a master's level counselor, we had several master's level counselors, we had a psychologist on staff, we had certified school teachers because it was a kind of alternative education program. We had lots of education and expertise that we were throwing at this problem. And we were hitting some pretty good outcomes, nothing to sneeze at. But then my wife started this Big Brother, Big Sister program. And it was about the time that the organization had released this nationwide longitudinal study. And they were hitting outcomes that we could only dream of. And they were doing it for pennies a day. And what were they doing? What was the secret? They were putting an adult into a child's life. They took an adult who was a positive role model and placed it with a young person who was at risk for all sorts of issues and problems. And they were hitting some great, great outcomes. It's really that simple. All of us can be ambassadors for connection and health. We just have to get involved. Connection. In human services, we have as one of our maxims, first do no harm. So whenever we intervene, at a minimum, we don't want to make the situation worse. But sometimes it takes a little bit of luck. It's not all about expertise. When I was working in that group home, we took the boys down to Assateague Island for a camping trip. Sounds wonderful, doesn't it? We walked in, we got in there in the evening, we opened up the van, and the mosquitoes just swarmed us. and the black flies, or the horse flies, the big ones, you know, that are, you can see them coming from 50 yards away. So we had a rough night. The next morning when we got up, some of the kids said, "Hey, can we take the raft down to the shoreline?" We're like, "Sure, but just stay right along the shore." So we made breakfast and we got to everyone's, tended to everyone's needs. And then after about, it took about an hour, we went down to check on the boys. And we're looking, we don't see them. We're looking some more, we don't see them. Finally, I get this tap on the shoulder and my workmate says, is that them? They're on the horizon in a rubber raft. I thought, oh my God, we're gonna have to call the Coast Guard. I thought my career was over. How are we gonna get these kids back to the shoreline? We're jumping up and down and waving, like, come in. It took them probably an hour to 2 hours to finally paddle their way back into the shore. As soon as they hit the shoreline, my coworker grabbed his pocket knife and just shredded that rubber raft. Nobody else was going out on that raft. But it takes a little bit of luck sometimes. And so I learned from that experience humility, right? And to be appreciative for the small favors and the good fortune that sometimes rains down on us. Then in my 30s, I moved, as I said, to Gettysburg to manage the state treatment program. And I got pretty chummy with the juvenile probation chief. He was placing kids in our program. We would often meet after work for a beer. And I remember this story he once told about a couple of kids that his agency had placed at Abraxas, which is a drug and alcohol facility for youth. And they have a facility over here in Forest County. I mean, you're on a dirt road for 10, 15 miles before you get to this facility. So people like my friend, the probation chief, love it because kids aren't running away from that program. They don't want to be in the woods at night walking 15 miles out to the main road. And in this field, whenever kids are placed, every 6 months they have to have a review before the judge. And it's incumbent upon the agency where the kids are placed to bring these kids back to their home county for these court hearings. Well, he was telling me how Abraxas refused to bring these two kids back, meaning that he had to send his officers all the way out to Forest County. Now, this is from Adams County, Gettysburg, all the way out to Forest County. It's about 4 or 5 hours. Bring them back for the court hearing, which lasts maybe 15 minutes, and then taking them back to the program. So he was going to have two officers out of his office for 2 days. He was not happy. And I said to him, so what are you going to do? He says, well, I'm never going to place another kid in that program. I'm like, yeah, but what if that's the right program for that child's needs? He says, I don't care. It pissed me off. I'm not sending him any more kids. And I thought, okay, this is how it really works, right? It's all about relationships. It's all about whether you're a cooperative, collaborative partner in this work that we do. And if you're not, you're not going to get the business. And so I learned from that relationships. Relationships are key. And I share this with my staff all the time. It's not just the relationship that we have with the client. It's the relationship we have with everybody that's in and out of our building that we deal with. So it's the plumbers who come to our building to keep our heat and cooling systems running efficiently. It's the UPS guy that's running in, dropping off a package, and running out. It's the postman who stops every day. And one day, I noticed after he dropped off the mail, he walked through the building and down into our conference room. I thought, well, that's odd. And I said to the staff person, where's he going? She says, oh, he's going down to use the bathroom. I'm like, well, how does he know we have a bathroom down here? He does this every day, Bruce. I'm like, how did I not know this? I don't know. But we're approved by the Postal Service for him to use our bathroom on a daily basis, which is great. I'm happy that we're doing that. I just didn't realize we were doing it. Well, I don't know, a few years ago, we dropped something off in the mail that should not have gone in the mail, and we were beside ourselves with, how are we going to get this out of the mail? Because they don't let you go back in and pull stuff out. But I think because we had a relationship with this postal carrier, he was able to retrieve the letter for us. Yay. Relationships, very important. And not that it's transactional. We certainly don't form relationships with people because of what we may get from it. But having relationships with people makes it possible for the impossible to happen. Sometimes life's little lessons come in the form of a simple comment, not necessarily from a life-altering experience. When I was working in Central PA before I came here in a domestic violence program, one of my employees, a woman in her late 30s, early 40s, wanted to go and get her bachelor's degree. And so she enrolled at Penn State and was taking classes one, two, a semester. And she realized at some point, wow, this is going to take me a long time. And she said, I may be 50 before I get my degree. And I was like, yeah. But we had this other person working for us. She was in her 70s, and she was very wise. And she said, well, God willing, you're going to be 50 regardless. So do you want to be 50 with a degree or 50 without a degree? And I thought, wow, that is brilliant. That is just so brilliant of a way of looking at this. And that taught me perspective. How we frame things in our mind goes a long way to how we think about it, how we deal with it, how we interact with it. Perspective. Have a good perspective. When I got here, speaking of perspective, I came downstairs, and I usually stop in at the shelter office before I walk out, and I noticed the shelter manager was putting plastic over her computer. I said, what are you doing? She goes, well, it's going to rain tonight. I'm like, yeah, but why are you putting plastic over your computer? She says, well, the roof leaks. I said, well, I guess that's one way of managing this problem, but perhaps we could get the roof fixed. She goes, oh, Bruce, that's not how we do things here. There's no funding for that. And about that time, I watched somebody bring a chair in from outside. I'm like, what are you doing? And she says, oh, somebody was throwing this away. It was out on the curb. I'm like, yeah, but why are you bringing it in here? She says, because it's better than the chair I have. I said, well, we'll just get you a new chair. Oh, no, Bruce, that's not how we do things here. There's no money for chairs. I says, look, we'll find the money. We've got to get out of this poverty mentality that we're in. Perspective. So when I first got here 16 years ago, I sat down with each of my new employees and I spoke with them privately and individually and said, what is it you want me to know about you and your work here at the agency? And some of them used that opportunity to whine and complain. Some were pushing forward their agenda. Some were just blowing smoke up my arse, right? But one person, however, said to me, I'm bored. And you cannot give me enough to do. Now, here it is 16 years later, and I still remember that. Like, what a great opening, right? What a great way to impress your new boss. And so I tested the theory here. I kept throwing stuff at her. Like, well, then take this on. Can you do this? And I did that for 2 years. Finally, she yelled, Uncle, okay, my plate is full. You can't do any more. But in that two-year period, she got the office next to mine. She had been in the reception area, just answering calls and making copies for people. Now she's my right-hand person, and we've been a good team ever since. But it all started with that, I'm bored, you can't give me enough to do. So what am I talking about? I'm talking about workplace culture. Now this has been the bane of my existence, because changing culture is hard, almost impossible. I've been at it now for 16 years, and while we've certainly moved in the direction in which I want us to go, we're nowhere near where I thought we would be after 16 years. I think it's probably the hardest part of any CEO's job. You're working against tradition, entrenched ideas, long-standing habits, poor attitudes, and then what I call the drama pushers, the underminers, and the saboteurs. But an organization is only as strong as its culture. In fact, it's been noted that 84% of the value of an S&P 500 company comes from the talents, the skills, the knowledge, the work ethic, and the health of its employees. And so if you're going to change the culture, you have to have nearly everyone on board. You have to trust them, and they have to trust you. Some Native American tribes had a custom where if they didn't like the direction in which the chief was taking them, if they thought the chief was getting too chiefly, they would just up and move away in the middle of the night. No drama, no conflict. They just up and moved. And I've always remembered that story because every morning that I come to women's services, I hope and pray that somebody's still there. Another thing that I heard from staff during those initial discussions was, what am I going to do about all the stealing in the shelter? And so I asked, well, what are we talking about? Oh, what are we not talking about? Sheets and towels, pots and pans, food, utensils, artwork. I actually had a woman who tried to take a huge framed picture out the shelter door. We're like, whoa, stop. No, somebody gave it to me. No, I don't think anyone gave it to you. But my answer to this was, because they're looking at me like, how are you going to handle this? My answer to it was, well, let's let them have it. And they're like, what? I'm like, if they need these things, let's give it to them. And let's do it in a way that they don't feel they have to steal it. Let's just make it available to them. And the answer I got was, well, then all of our supplies will disappear. We won't have anything. I'm like, no, it's not how it works. The more you give, the more you receive. And we put that theory into practice, and they saw over time that it works. We have so much supplies. We have so much. And anytime that we do get low on anything, all I do is I put the word out, and then whew, people bring it. It's amazing how this works. Rules and expectations. When I arrived at the shelter, there were signs and rules plastered everywhere. No cooking after 10. Turn the lights out when leaving the room. These were all signs plastered on the walls. No food in the living room. Clean your dishes after using them. Children must be in bed by 11. On and on it went. And yet, all these problems persisted. It didn't stop anybody from taking food out of the kitchen. It didn't mean that kids would actually be down and asleep by 11 o'clock. It reminded me of that joke about social workers. How many social workers does it take to change a light bulb? Answer: the light bulb must first fill out the appropriate forms to determine eligibility for service. Yeah, well, we would see that at intake as well. Staff were so intent on answering all the questions on the intake form that they forgot to form a relationship with the person they were talking to. They weren't listening for what was happening. They were listening for the form to fill out the appropriate form to make sure that all the blanks were filled in. They forgot that the purpose of an intake is not to get those answers. The purpose of an intake is to begin building a rapport. These are the first moments to form that relationship. And it's also the first opportunity we have to make a good impression. And do we want that impression to be all about the form, or do we want it to be about relationship, about listening, about hearing what's going on in this person's life? So building an organizational culture in human services with intention is critical to providing excellent care. Workplace cultures can develop by default, or they can be developed with intention. In cultures that exist by design, a clear understanding of mission and purpose is practiced through shared values. This has been my goal. Conversely, in cultures that exist by default, the environment and its practices are driven not by a central mission, but by the agenda of the most powerful members of that organization. When an organization does not shape its own destiny through shared values, it becomes vulnerable to dysfunction. And so we have spent a lot of time working on mission, vision, core values. John Brodigan, who's in attendance today, is one of my board members. He knows the anguish and the pain that we went through to develop our mission, vision, and core values. These are not easy things to do, but once you get them established and you begin to promote them, it can make all the difference. So building culture in human services with intention is critical because what we model as professionals impacts our clients' ability to meaningfully cope and overcome their own challenges. They take their cues from us. So it comes down to this. The last lesson I learned in human services, and perhaps the first I learned in kindergarten or Sunday school or from my parents, is if you want to live, or if you want to be on a great team, you have to be a great teammate. If you want to live in a great community, you've got to be a great community member. And if you want to have a great church, you've got to be a great church member. Right? It's in your hands. I remember saying back in 1982, after I had spent a year working in the group home, that given all that I had been through and all the effort that I had been expending, there better be at least one kid who says, you made a difference in my life. And then as the years would go by and I worked with more and more people, I used to think, well, better be more than one. Better be a whole handful. And then maybe even a whole busful. But now that I'm at the end of my career, you know, that's really not the case. One would be sufficient. And I was granted that blessing a few years after I stopped working in the group home. I ran into that young lady. She was now a young adult. And she had the gumption to say to me, "You saved my life. If not for you, I would be dead." Maybe she would, maybe she wouldn't. But hearing that made me think, okay, it was all worthwhile. And so I don't seek that kind of acknowledgement or validation from others. I got that one. I mean, if that's it, if it's just the one life, that's sufficient, right? And all of you are capable of doing the same, of saving someone's life by just making that connection, by having some humility, by prioritizing relationships, having the proper perspective, and then being that thing that you want to see more of. Those are the lessons that I learned in human services. But I'm elderly now. I'm a veteran of human services, yes, and my career is nearly over, but not necessarily my ability to make new and life-affirming connections with others. For those of us who were born in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and who are we? Raise your hand. If you were born in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, okay. Don't be ashamed. It's okay. Baby boomers, basically, right? I want to leave you with this poem. We were born in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. We grew up in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. We studied in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and we began dating in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. We got married and discovered the world in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. We ventured into the 80s and 90s. We stabilized in the 2000s. We got wiser in the 2010s, and we are going firmly through and beyond 2020. Turns out we have lived through 8 different decades, 2 different centuries, 2 different millennia. We have gone from the telephone with an operator for long-distance calls to video calls to anywhere in the world. We have gone from slides, remember slides, to YouTube, from vinyl records to online music, from handwritten letters to email, even WhatsApp. From live matches on the radio to black and white TV, color TV, to 3D HD TV. We went to the video store and now we watch Netflix. We got to know the first computers, punch cards, floppy disk, and now we have megabytes and gigabytes on our smartphones. We wore shorts throughout our childhood and then long trousers, Oxfords, flares, shell suits, and blue jeans. Don't forget the polyester leisure suit. It's one of my favorites. We dodged infantile paralysis, meningitis, polio, tuberculosis, swine flu, and COVID. We rode skates, tricycles, bicycles, mopeds, gas cars, and now we drive hybrids and EVs. Yes, we've been through a lot, but what a great life we've had. What a wonderful world it has been. We had an analog childhood and a digital adulthood. We've kind of seen it all. Our generation has literally lived through and witnessed more than any other in any dimension of life. We are the generation that connects what was to what will be. We are the great connectors. So let's give a big round of applause to all the members of this very special generation. Thank you for having me again today. I look forward to coming back before I permanently leave this community, which still may be a year to 2 years away. And I think as we wrap up here, it is my job to announce that if you are able, please stand for hymn 131, which the choir is going to come up and help us sing. 131.